Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi everybody, before we get into the podcast here, just to let you know, we are back in Cork's Opera House on August the 22nd to open the Cork Podcast Festival.
Which is an absolute honour, and myself and James are thrilled to be a part of such a great night, particularly when you have so many fantastic podcasts coming from Cork on the night and the week as well.
Yeah, no, listen, it's great to be part of the podcast scene. And we've a great guest on the night too, a friend of ours, Brezzy, a mental health advocate who's got a great story. Among other things, he's played Munster or rugby with Leinster, and he had a panic attack live on TV, and he does his own show now around his own journey. So it's going to be powerful.
Yeah, he's just going to talk about his story growing up and when it all started for him in relation to his mental health, and how he came through it, and what he does today around it. No, he does a lot of work within schools today and helps children to be able to cope much, much better with their own mental health, and he creates programs and stuff like that, and he does a lot of funding. So it should be a fantastic night.
Yeah, we'll have a bit of entertainment, a bit of music and a bit of a crack as well. So I hope to see you there August the 22nd. Tickets available at ticketmaster.ie or Cork Opera House box office. Thank you and enjoy the podcast. Hello everybody and welcome back to the Two Norries podcast. I am your host James Ennard, joined as always by my good friend Timmy Long.
Hi everyone.
Our guest this evening is Dr. Sinead Kane from Youghal, and you have a fierce list of achievements including two Guinness World Records, a couple of PhDs, and you do a bit of keynote speaking and stuff like that as well.
Thanks very much for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, and you have a visual impairment also.
Yeah, I'm visually impaired, registered as blind, just 5% vision.
Were you born like that?
Yeah, congenital. So everybody in my family are visually impaired.
Oh, really? So if it's in the genes, is it a guarantee that the offspring get it? Or?
Well, my sister has a child and she doesn't have the vision impairment, so it can skip a generation.
Interesting. And how much can you see?
So I suppose a lot of people think about blindness as in darkness. So I think that's a misconception. So a lot of my problem is I take in too much light. So if you can imagine the full headlights of a car coming at you with the full headlights on, it's very dazzling on the eyes. So that's a lot of my problem. So I have aniridia, coloboma, nystagmus and glaucoma. So aniridia is where like you take in too much light. Coloboma is a part missing of the eye. The part missing of my eye is the iris. The nystagmus is shaking of the eyes, and the glaucoma is high pressure. So because the iris is the coloured part of your eye, so I can't see the colours of your eyes. So the iris is the blue, the brown or the green. So if you take off that colour part of your eye, then, because like it's the pupil, the black in the centre of the eye that takes the light in. But if you take off the coloured part of the eye, then you're taking light through the whole eye. Yeah. So that's what it's kind of like for me.
And so have you just got pupils?
So I don't really, actually my pupil isn't really defined, as in my eyes are black. Everybody thinks my eyes are dark brown, but they're actually black. So I take light through the whole eye. So it's like an open camera lens all the time. Mm. So light, like I suffer badly with the light. Like when I'm looking at the light, it's like as if there's kind of arrows sticking out of the light. Or if I'm looking at the light in the house, in where I'm from, or any kind of light, it's like there's all rays sticking out of the light.
It's like, do you know if...
But I know that there's no rays. Like,
do you know if somebody that doesn't have a visual impairment walks into a dark room, and then the pupils open up to try and take in more light.
That's probably it.
But it's like you have that all the time.
Yeah.
So you're taking in too much light all the time.
So like, say for example, during my college days, I would have went out at night time, as students do, and I'd go towards the door to get in, and I would have often been stopped by bouncers. One bouncer actually said to me, "Sorry, we don't take anybody here on e-tablets."
Because it's the same thing what happens to us.
Yeah. So like, they would directly say that out. And I suppose it was embarrassing in front of my friends, but my friends would have known that, okay, she doesn't take drugs or anything like that, but it was still embarrassing. And there was one particular nightclub in the city where I tried to get in, and they basically said, "Oh no, like, you're on drugs," and all this. And I just said, "Oh, can you just clarify for me?" Being a law student, I was like, can you just clarify that you're stopping me based on my eyes? Yeah. They were saying, "Oh yeah, well, it's because your eyes are dilated." So I said, "Thank you very much." I had witnesses the following day, wrote a letter to the management. I was stopped based on my eyes. This is not good enough. I'll take legal action against your organisation or company. But anyway, they did send out an apology to me, sent out loads of free passes, but I didn't go back to that establishment again. Mm. But it just shows, like, I suppose, the barriers that you can experience as a person with a disability, the assumption that is made. Because for them, I don't know, would they have stopped me so quickly had I had out my white cane, had I had on my black shaded sunglasses.
Yeah, yeah,
now,
yeah.
I was linking my friends. Now, I know they have a job to do, and they're there to, like, obviously prevent, I suppose, arguments in their establishment. But like, if I say to them, "Oh, I've aniridia, collarbone, nystagmus and glaucoma," and start going into detail about my eye conditions, I think it's fairly reliable that I know what I'm talking about in terms of being visually impaired. So I suppose that would be a memory for me from my college days. Yeah. A memory from my younger years of my visual impairment would always be going for an eye checkup every, say, 3 to 6 months. And I remember going up to the hospital, and like, you'd be sitting and you'd be told by the nurse to read the chart. And I'd always watch these other kids get a lollipop if they got down to the end of the chart. And I always thought to myself, like, this is completely unfair, because I'm born visually impaired. I'm never going to get down to the end of the chart. I could always only see the first letter on the chart. So I kind of started saying to myself, okay, what I'll do is I'll tell the child beside me to go first, and then I'll just quickly memorise what they say, and then tell the nurse that I want to do my turn. So that's what I kind of started doing. Like, I would memorise what the other child said, and then tell the nurse I wanted to go ahead and call out. And then she'd be like, okay, this child got down as far as the end of the chart. And then the doctor would be completely confused, and then he'd make me kind of go through the chart in his room, and then I wouldn't be able to see the chart in his room. And then he'd realise, okay, this child obviously was copying other kids.
No lollipop.
Yeah, no lollipop. So I just thought it was a very unfair system.
Absolutely.
And I spoke up and I told the doctors and I told the nurses, this is kind of discrimination against me as a child. So I suppose, like, there's always different barriers all throughout my life that I've experienced. But I think that you can be a role model and kind of be an advocate. And like, I suppose back then, I told the doctors, well, why can't I have the lollipop? And I suppose it's only by speaking out, or it's only by putting people, organisations or companies in their place by saying, like, okay, well, why did you stop me based on my eyes? And just being an advocate for yourself and using your voice wisely. Mm-hmm. Like, my sister has a visual impairment as well. She uses a guide dog, and she would go around the city, and there's particular traffic lights around Cork City that are never, ever working. And like, herself and other guide dog owners have experienced it as well, where they've contacted different relevant people to try and get these traffic lights working, because like, a traffic light working mightn't be a big deal to a fully sighted person. But to a visually impaired person, it is a huge deal because of their safety.
Yeah. You unbelievably intelligent from a young child. You know, like most kids wouldn't be able to remember anything like that. You know, the chart, being able to remember what the young person before you is after saying on the chart. Like, were you a very, very smart child inside in school, or was your impairment an issue in relation to learning as well?
Well, I think that there's two types of people. One type of person is a person in flow, and another type of person is a grafter. Yeah. And I'm definitely a grafter. I'm not a person in flow. Doesn't all come naturally to me. I have to put in the hard work. So in school, in primary school, secondary school, I would have struggled. Like, for example, say when I was reading my book, when you're reading it with a magnifying glass, depending on how big the magnifying glass is, like, you might end up reading the sentence slower compared to if it's in very large font. So when I would be trying to read with a very tiny magnifying glass, I would be reading slower. And so then they were kind of questioning, they'd be questioning, okay, well, does this girl have an intellectual disability as well as a visual impairment?
Yeah.
But they weren't taking account of, okay, if this is in large print, she can easily read it, no problem. So coming back to your question, was I a very intelligent child? No, I worked very hard. There were stages where they thought that I had an intellectual disability. I was always the only child walking up and down to the blackboard to see what was on the blackboard. I was always the only child having black shaded sunglasses on in school or the white cane. My experience of school isn't a happy memory for me.
Were you bullied?
Yeah, badly bullied, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Very badly bullied. And I suppose kind of that did have a drastic effect on my mental health. Back then, I think people have coping mechanisms, positive and negative. And I suppose I just went into the coping mechanism of, I don't want to go to school.
Yeah.
And what way can I not go to school? Okay, if I say I'm sick, then I won't have to go to school. But like, I suppose then you have to be sick, because you can't just keep saying, oh, I'm sick, I'm sick, I'm sick.
Yeah.
So you actually have to be sick. So I kind of would sometimes just, I suppose, make myself weak by just not eating or that type of way. And I suppose, yeah, energy levels wouldn't be there. And
did you develop an eating disorder on your teens or anything like that?
So I suppose for me, that's, I suppose kind of, I don't know how you want to label it, but I suppose for me, I just don't, I had issues with food. That's the way I would like to say it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What about your teens then? Like, with, let's say, 16, 17-year-olds out socialising, maybe going to clubs or going with boys or girls or whatever. Was that difficult for you?
So, I suppose, like, in primary school and secondary school, I was the type of child who was, I don't know, I just was an awkward child. I was very shy. I just felt, I don't know, in school that, like, say in PE, any time a team was being picked for PE, I was always the last child to be picked onto the team. And when the team did pick me, they didn't want me on their team anyway. So, and then outside of school, I would always remember just never having actually a particular set group of friends. I would always kind of float between friends and just never really felt belonged to any particular group. And I suppose growing up, like, I never, I never got into drink or drugs or anything like that. And I don't know, I just kept myself to myself, and I would have went to maybe discos with my sister or anything. But I don't really, wouldn't have kind of socialised with people from my school as much. And I suppose, like, looking back, I wonder to myself, what if, like, if people did accept me, would I have had a more better childhood or whatever? Like, because, like, some people talk about, oh, like, we'd get cans and we'd go behind the back of a shed and go drinking or whatever. And I never ever had that. And I kind of wondered to myself, oh, like, did I miss out by not being able to do that?
Yeah. Did you ever go to Gigi's in the Hilltop?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
So old disco back in the day, do you remember that?
Yeah, that was the wild old place, yeah.
So I suppose just to let listeners know I'm from Yall. Would you have went down to Yall?
Yeah, I was telling Sinead before, like, Yall is like Santa Panza for Narries back in the day.
It was too, yeah.
Yeah, I had a few great down there in June and come home.
I had a few mad nights down in Yall, but there was just one thing I was going to say to you in relation to the way you felt as a young child, you know, in social contexts with people not being able to make relationships work or our friends and stuff like that. Is that the same today? Is that kind of social anxiety, is that the same today? Are you much more open, or did you do some work on yourself around that stuff?
I think I'm a lot more confident now as a person. And I think I'm kind of at the stage in life where, do you know what, I really don't care what you think of me, that type of individual. And I don't crave this desire to be part of a group anymore. Like, I always thought to myself, okay, well, if I change myself, that group will accept me. So I need to change. I don't really crave that now anymore. But I suppose from my childhood, what I would have found is that trust is a huge issue for me regarding forming friendships. I find it very difficult to trust people and let that guard down.
Have you been hurt before by somebody?
Well, I suppose just the bullying that I experienced in primary school and secondary school, then
that forms your worldview.
Yeah,
people can be bad.
Yeah, so like, I suppose it's just kind of, I remember times when I was younger that kids would say that they're going to invite me to parties or Halloween parties, and then they wouldn't turn up or something like that. And I suppose that trust then is kind of gone.
That stuff really hurts a child, doesn't it? It really, really hurts a child. I would have had a similar kind of upbringing to you myself. You know, no, I wouldn't have been, had the same kind of, I don't know what you call it. Is it a disability?
It's a disability.
I wouldn't have, but where I grew up and the environment I grew up in, it was really difficult. So I can completely relate to your story as a young child, because I really didn't fit in. Relationships were very, very difficult. I had no confidence, I had no self-esteem, you know. I was, because of the way I looked and all these other things. And it can be really, really tough. That stuff can be really, really tough for a child. And when JM said there a while ago in relation to the addiction, did you end up going down the drinking drugs route? You know, a lot of people who do have those kind of lifestyles as a young child, they do go down that route. Because what they seem to happen is later on in life, when they go down that route of drinking drugs, the things that they don't have, the confidence, the self-esteem, you know, the ability to be around others and to be able to talk, comes from the alcohol and drugs. It never came for me unless I had the drinking drugs in my system. And when that happened, it was like, oh my God. It was like someone was just after opening Pandora's box for me. It was the best thing ever. And it kind of escalated then into just complete madness. And that happens with a lot of people.
I don't know, maybe I might have went down the route of alcohol had I been invited to parties or whatever, but I just never was. So I would have been at home a lot, and in my household, like, there was never any drink. Like, my dad doesn't drink, or my parents don't drink, or my sister wouldn't really drink either. So there was never really drink in the house. So I don't know, I suppose I been invited to parties, I might have. But like, I just, as I say, I just kind of have those experiences, kind of like, say, even with my Debs, I don't feel that I actually had that experience of a Debs of what other people had. Because like, even the guy that I went with, he just kind of went just to show for a photograph and then he left. So, and then like, kind of, even as I say, just the one or two people that I was hanging around with at that time, I just still didn't feel part of their group. So again, I left my Debs early and all that. So
Did you have the support of your sister, and what parent was visually impaired?
Both my parents are visually impaired, and my sister, yeah. So, like, I suppose I would have had a lot of support from my sister, and we would have been kind of, she would have experienced, like, she would experience disability differently to me. Like, I think the important thing when we started off this conversation about disability is, what, like, tell us about your disability. And I started explaining about my vision impairment, but everybody, I'm only one person talking about disability. You could have another guest in who's visually impaired, and they might have a completely different experience than me. Like, so, I think that that's important. So, like, myself and my sister would have had commonalities regarding the vision impairment, but we do also would have had differences as well. I suppose, like, looking back on my childhood as well, like, a lot of teenagers learn to drive. Some teenagers might go off and not learn to drive, but they don't.
Or drive cars they shouldn't be.
Yeah. So, again, again, I would have never kind of experienced that. And I kind of say to myself, okay, well, have I missed out there? Yeah. So I was having a conversation with a friend back in maybe my early 30s about how I kind of felt that I kind of had missed out on that as a teenager. And even kind of the fact of being visually impaired, I'll never be able to drive. Well, I can drive, but I'm not allowed the license, so I should clarify that. So he said to me, okay, well, look, you hold tight and I'm going to do something for you tonight. So I was like, okay, what the hell, what's going to be happening? So we went down to Little Island at midnight, and we went into this car park that was completely empty. And he said, okay, I want you to get out of the car now and I want you to drive around this car park. I was like, okay, this could go very badly. Like, your car could actually get very badly damaged. So anyway, I got into the car and we were going around and around and around this car park. And I'd say anybody who passed the car park probably was thinking, what is going on with that car? So, yeah, so I suppose that was just his way of trying to make me feel happy about myself. And then we came back up to Cork City. We went to North Main Street. We got a pizza. And then the following morning, I ended up with food poisoning from the pizza. And then I didn't contact him because I was sick. And then he thought that he'd done something wrong. And yeah, so
was it meant to be? Yeah. That's the way you have to look at it.
Oh, yeah. So it was good night. And yeah, so that's kind of, I think it's nice to try and put yourself in the shoes. Like, because when he got into the into the passenger seat, I said, are you sure maybe you don't want to actually just get out just in case something happens? And he was like, no, I trust you. And I was like, okay, like, this is a huge amount of trust now. So
sounds like a nice old fella.
So
you have two world records for long distance running.
Yeah.
Was sport always like an outlet for you as a kid, or was that something that you got into later in life?
So I didn't take up running until age 30. So I suppose a message that I'd like to send out to anybody is, if you can't think that you can't do something, I never thought I'd end up running in the Irish singlet representing Ireland, but I have. And I only took up running at age 30 because I was asked to do a 10K for Child Vision, National Education Centre for Blind and Visually Impaired Children. So they asked me to do a 10K, the Women's Mini Marathon, in June 2012. And I set myself 8 weeks of training. At the start, I found it difficult to find a running guide, but I found a running guide. And so I did 8 weeks training, set myself two goals, to do it under an hour, and I did it in 55 minutes, and then to raise over €2,000 for Child Vision, and I did that. And so once I did that 10K, then, like, that summer, I just said to myself, okay, my confidence has grown now. I'd like to join a running club. So I joined a running club, and when I went into this running club, they were like, don't run on the road with the other athletes in case you fall, or don't run around the track faster than 8 minute miling in case you fall. And I just kind of felt like a caged animal.
Yeah.
And that goes against my personal values and my professional values of wanting to grow. So I left that running club. I was out of running for a while. And Yeah, I was out running for a while, and then I decided, oh, I'll do a half marathon in June 2014. So the Cork half marathon, June 2014, did that. And at the end of the half marathon, I was saying to myself, geez, that was like not easy, but like more that was very manageable. Yeah. And so then I said to myself, okay, that I was going to do full marathon in July 2014. I set myself about doing the Dublin marathon for October 2014. And at that time, I was doing a lot of voluntary work with Childline, so the crowd that answers the ISPCC. Yeah. And so I said to myself, okay, I should get a running guide, no problem, because like blind girl doing it for charity, loads of people come forward. Nobody came forward, so I was kind of like, that kind of upset me in a way.
So you need somebody to run alongside you?
Yeah, so that kind of upset me in a way, because there's so many running clubs around Cork City, and yet nobody came forward, or even Cork County.
Yeah.
So then I just put out this tweet at the end of July 2014 that blind girl wants to do it for charity. She can't find a running guide, so I'm not going to be able to do it. So then a guy in Dublin came forward and he said, I'll run with you. So I was travelling up on a train for 3 hours to do a 2-hour run to then travel back down the train for 3 hours. So I was on a train for 6 hours to do a 2-hour run. So anybody who kind of takes their sight for granted or whatever needs to reassess their goals.
Yeah.
So like, it's how badly you want your goals. And I suppose I badly wanted to do this Dublin Marathon. So that's why I went to the effort of going that length to go up on the train. And I suppose I saw a bigger purpose than me. It wasn't all about Sinead doing the marathon. It was about raising money for Childline, so the bigger purpose. So that's why I was willing to sacrifice my own time to go up and down on the train.
Did you? Sorry, James. I was just going to ask you, did you go to college after school?
Yeah. So when I was 17, I approached my careers advisor teacher and I told her I wanted to study law. And her attitude, it was a reading based subject. You'll never be able for it. There's no point doing it. So I said, thank you very much for that information. I left the school that time and went home and researched all about where can I study law. And I suppose what I had to do also was to see which college would have the best disability services. It wasn't just, okay, which college would have the best law services. It was disability had to be taken into account. So thankfully for me, it was UCC out of all the colleges in Ireland. So UCC was the best. And just went to UCC then. And I said to myself, okay, I'm going to prove this careers advisor teacher wrong. And first year, I just felt like imposter syndrome, because I remember the first day of my first class, sat down beside these two girls and like they were like saying, I said to them, oh, when did you want to start studying law? And they were like, oh, since I was 8 or 9, my parents are barristers and this, that and the other. And here's me coming like from a background of nobody's in the legal profession in my. So I kind of felt like very much an imposter. And like some of them, the way the accents of some of them just wasn't like my y'all accent.
Yeah.
And so I suppose first year was hard. Reading all the textbooks was quite difficult. I'd get pains in my eyes, pains in my wrist, pains in my lower back the whole time. And and then again, I had to say to myself, okay, how can I get through this course? And how you get through the course is you had to make sacrifices. So like, because my eyes would get sore quite easily, I would spread out my reading. So I would do some reading in the morning, some reading in the evening. But by doing my reading in the evening, then I won't be able to go out socialising like all other students.
Yeah.
So again, the disability was kind of impacting me. So I felt that I wasn't getting the full college experience as others. And then I went from a situation of in school getting hardly any supports to then in college getting loads of supports. And at the time I was thinking to myself, okay, this is absolutely fantastic. But then by second and third year, I was kind of copping on, saying to myself, okay, Sinead, like when you go into the big bad world, like you're not going to have all these supports. So you're going to get a shock if you're going to be leaning on all these supports too much. So you kind of need to empower yourself to. So like, say, when I read a law textbook in solicitors' offices, they use dictaphones.
Yeah.
Well, back then, anyway, I don't know how it is now with technology and everything.
They do, actually.
So I would have said my note rather than write out my notes, I would have said my notes into the dictaphone. Then I would have played the dictaphone back to myself and listened. And I absolutely hate hearing the sound of my voice, but I had to listen to this dictaphone. Your question was, did I go off to college? So I did. And in second year, then I decided, OK, I was giving it up. It was too difficult. So I said to my parents I was giving it up, and they said, that's fine. And I was kind of getting a bit, why are you saying this is fine? Like, you're meant to kind of get a bit annoyed that I'm giving up. This is how it works in the movies.
Yeah.
And so they said, no, you're an adult now. You have to take responsibility. If this is a mistake, you have to take it on. So they said, we'll go to London for a shopping trip. And I thought to myself, OK, this is a great reward for giving up. We went to London. We didn't go shopping. We went to Chancery Lane and we met a judge who was totally blind. And he became a role model to me. And I discussed everything with him about law, or everything other than law.
Yeah.
And I came back full of confidence, got my law degree, got my master's in law, qualified as a solicitor. So I suppose in life, I think you have to have role models.
Yeah.
Like, if I was to say to you there, like, who would be a role model to you?
A role model to me?
Yeah.
I suppose my wife, Gillian.
Yeah.
When she came into my life at the right time, somebody I could relate with, that was a bit further down the line, like that judge with you, that was in a similar field that I wanted to be in, and that had kind of gone the path before me, that I could use for counsel to kind of guide me along the way and encourage me as I went down that path, you know. So I probably my wife was the first one that comes to mind, Ruth.
Probably Donald. You know, Donald would have been somebody I met in treatment early on, and he had a similar story to me. And after hearing his story, I understood that it was possible to have recovery in my life and that I could do it as well. And he definitely inspired me to keep going. And today, you know, we're good friends. And it's like I'm after hitting the place that he was back in when I was in treatment, you know. So I'm in that place. And definitely, without that role model at the beginning, I'd say I would have been a little bit lost. Mm-hmm. So it definitely helped me.
I think we can all be role models to our thoughts, our actions and our behaviours every day. And like you were asking me there, when did I start running? Did I do it from a very young age? And I didn't start it until 30. Mm. And like, even with yourselves there now, you've taken on the podcast later in life. You weren't doing a podcast when you were young, but you're doing it now later in life. And I think that kind of, we can all be role models. You're showing being role model. You're showing leadership through that.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? And you can be your own advocate and your own leader and your own family. It doesn't have to be like world records like what you're doing and, you know, lecturing in UCC.
Yeah. Well, I think that leadership is when you bring people along with you.
Yeah.
And I also think that leadership is an act, not a position.
Yeah.
So for me, leadership isn't about titles or anything like that. It's how you act on a daily basis, and especially how you act when nobody is looking. Because a lot of people would say to me, how have you gained success, or how have you got your goals? And for me, success is what you do in private when nobody's looking. Like, for example, are you willing to help a person on a street when nobody's looking? Are you willing to do it when there's a big crowd standing there? Or like, for example, with me with the running, like, you need protein to help build muscle and repair. So like, I can tell people, I eat loads of protein, but like, am I actually doing it in private?
Sometimes the people in the leadership positions are the worst leaders. So it's true what you're saying. Just because somebody's in the position, that doesn't make a great leader.
Yeah.
And sometimes the staff of that leader might have more leadership qualities than them by how they conduct their behaviour and their professionalism and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think as well it comes down to as well about empathy and emotional intelligence. And like, even after I qualified as a solicitor, I remember that I went to, I knew some prison officers in Mountjoy, and I said, would you mind if I had a tour of Mountjoy? So I was brought to Mountjoy, and the prisoners were in their cells, the doors were locked, and I remember walking in and walking down, and like, they were all jeering, and that for me was extremely intimidating. And so anyway, then we got down to a cell and there was one guy outside and he was, I don't know, he was doing sweeping anyway or something. And I said to the prison officer who was in myself and two people that I brought with me, I said to the prison officer, look, would you mind if I actually go into that prisoner's cell? So he asked the prisoner, would the prisoner mind? And he said, okay, no problem. So I went into the cell and then I asked the prison officer, like, would you mind actually locking the door? And the reason why I did that was because, I don't know, I just wanted to experience what it's like to be in prison, just to try and get a sense, a feel for it. And then came out.
What did you feel like, if yeah?
I have a fear now of small spaces.
It's very small, isn't it?
Trying to leave them.
Yeah, so I think there's two standout moments.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
For me, that has made me have a fear of small spaces. Like, I don't like going into lifts or anything. Like, if you're going to the seventh floor, I'd actually prefer to walk the stairs. Then take the lift. Like, but a second incident of where a small space was that I had been to Antarctica with the World Marathon Challenge. And when I came back from that, I wanted to kind of experience, just go back to that memory. And I remember I went into this amusement place that had this cylinder where it was like a computer game and you stand into the cylinder and it blowed a load of wind and all this. So I was in this cylinder and then the door closed and the wind was like really strong and I just got claustrophobic in there and I started panicking and I wanted to get out. So they're the two standout memories for me of dealing with kind of small spaces. But as I say, I just feel kind of a lot of people don't put themselves into other people's shoes. And so that was one of my experiences of kind of encountering the prison. And then I went to the women's prison and I found that the women's prison was quite different to the men's prison.
Way different, isn't it?
Yeah. And I remember I was told, don't talk to the prisoners now. If anybody talks to you, don't talk to them. So this girl then started talking to me and I was like, oh, she's going to be very rude now if I don't talk back to her. So I just talked back to her. And again, just very nice person. And I kind of think people think, oh, prisoner, they're not nice people. But I think that maybe just you just have to talk to people. And and then as I was training as a solicitor, I would have encountered prisoners through my solicitor traineeship. I would have went up to Cork Prison. And like the two areas that I was dealing with as a trainee solicitor was family law and criminal law. And family law, what I found is that like the client will come in and they'll talk. And you just actually have to get to the point where, okay, stop talking now. Yeah. I'll tell you about the law now. And then the criminal area, you'd go to prison and you'd ask the client a question. Yes, no, and there's no talk. So like it's the opposite, the extreme. Like, so I suppose they would have been my experiences. And I always used to wonder like, oh, will the client feel that their case is being jeopardised by me as a solicitor with a disability. Because I think there's a lot of, and not just even clients, there's a lot of society that has negative attitudes towards people with disabilities.
Yeah.
Like, I've had people say to me in the past, okay, what course are you doing? And then you explain, okay, well, I'm qualified at X, Y, Z. And they'd be like, oh, really, really? So they kind of talk to you one way, just because you have a disability. I think there's this negative attitude there.
Yeah, the thing with the difference between family law and how they speak and criminal law, you see, when it's involved with crime, the least you say, the better.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't say nothing at all, you're better off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in you, from a young age. Like, it doesn't matter if you're talking to the solicitor or the girls, when people are asking questions, you just say nothing. No comment until, you know, you get to your solicitor and you trust your solicitor in. And even at that, then you're kind of telling them in a roundabout way, you know.
There's always, people don't understand that inside in courthouses, they all mingle together, solicitors, judges, guards, you know. So you're just the client as is, and your solicitor's always going to look out for you. But for people that are in prison, the only people that they think are going to look out for them are the people that they come from the streets with. Then too, you know, it's such a kind of twist around. But yeah, but Sinead, so you went on to be a solicitor, yeah?
Yeah, so I found it very difficult then to get a job as a solicitor.
But okay.
You see, during my traineeship, I qualified in April 2009.
Mm-hmm.
That was the year of the recession.
Mm-hmm.
So I was with the Legal Aid Board, which is a public state body, and the embargo came in. So anybody on a temporary contract couldn't have their contract renewed because there was this embargo in the public state. So so I didn't have my contract renewed. Another solicitor, she didn't have her contract renewed. And so I was kind of saying to myself, okay, what am I going to do myself now? So I badly wanted a job as a solicitor. So I was finding that I was putting out a load of applications, and I go for interview, and when they see the white stick and black shaded sunglasses, just I had this sixth sense that, okay, there was a different tone in the room. So I just said, okay, I'll apply to Law Reform Commission. So I applied to them. They gave me a job, but it was a voluntary contract. So I was doing the exact same job as a paid person, but I wasn't being paid. And I knew that if I had them on my CV, that they're a prestigious body, that would be a good route to getting a job as a solicitor. So I had to say to myself, okay, how badly do you want your goals? So they were based in Dublin. I wasn't going to be paid. It was a full day, like 9 to 5:30. So what I did was I decided, okay, I'm not going to be couch surfing for 6 months, and I won't have any money to be staying in B&Bs and hotels and all of this. So every morning I got up at 4 a.m., got the 5 o'clock train to Dublin, got to Dublin at 8 a.m., got a bus out to Ballsbridge, was out there for 8:30, started work at 9, finished at 5:30, got a bus into Houston Station, got the train back to Cork at 7 o'clock, was back in Cork at 10 o'clock, and then got a taxi home for 10:30. And then up to bed by 11 and back up in the following morning at 4 o'clock.
How long did you do that for?
6 months. Jesus from the Christ. April to the October.
There's absolute motivation and strength. Fair play.
So the stuff you've had, it didn't come easy to you, sure it didn't?
Yeah, so while I was doing that anyway, there was a guy there and he said, I see you have a talent there for criminal law. Would you like to submit an article to the Irish Criminal Law Journal? So I thought anyway that this was only going to be one article. So I submitted the article anyway, and that was back in 2010. And 13 years later now, I'm still writing for the Irish Criminal Law Journal. So
did people, because of what you were doing there, just to get to work in Dublin every single morning coming home, did the people around you, maybe some of the higher up solicitors or the people who owned the company, not look at that and say, this girl is unreal?
So I suppose at the end of that contract, then I could have applied there for a paid contract, but then I just didn't like Dublin. I don't know. I've worked up there now a few times and I just cannot take to the place. Maybe it's just the Cork in me that I just...
Too big, too busy, it's the hustle and bustle, traffic, too many people.
then the following year, then I went to the public expenditure and reform in the Department of Public Expenditure Reform, and I was working as a legal researcher in there. And then the following year, then in 2012, I said to myself, okay, there needs to be more accessibility and there needs to be more openness in the legal profession about people with disabilities. So I approached the Law Society and I was asking them to put on a conference about disability and legal professionals and the law and all this. And they just, for whatever reason, didn't want to do it. They just, yeah, it just wasn't going to work out for them. And then approached Bar Council of Ireland, and again, similar roadblocks, didn't get through with it. So I said to myself, okay, well, this is fine if they don't want, if they're not able to do it, that's fine. But I'm not going to give up here. Like, I'm not that person. I'll just get knocked down and I'll get back up again. So then I contacted the International Bar Council. And luckily for me, that year in 2012, they were doing their event in Dublin. So normally it's other places around the world, but it was in Dublin that year. So I contacted them. They said, okay, no problem. If you want to do an event all about disability in the law and legal professionals, no problem, you can do it, but you have to do all the organising. So for 6 months, I did all this organising for this event at this International Bar Council. And one of the people on the panel was going to be this judge who was totally blind. And then, of course, the event was go ahead in September 2012, and then in the July 2012, he pulled out. And I think as well, this goes, say, for women, that women don't put themselves forward enough for things. So when he pulled out, I was kind of panicking, okay, this event has to go ahead. Like, I've put so much work into it. So who am I going to get? And then I just kind of said, you know what? I'm actually going to put myself forward. I'm going to put myself onto this panel. So I was on this panel with Sherry Blair, Tony Blair's wife, and then other legal professionals who just, I suppose, came from a completely different background to me, just very privileged, etc. So anyway, I said to myself, okay, how am I going to work it on that particular day? Am I going to, on this panel, come across as a person who knows everything about law and just keep talking about law? Or am I going to just let these other panelists talk, and when it comes time to use my voice wisely, I'll speak then? So I kind of went for the latter. And so the last kind of question on the day was, in the public sector, we have a quota to hire people with disabilities. So it's 3%. I think it's gone up to 6% now. But should we have that quota in the private sector that certain companies have to hire people with disabilities? And this Spanish lawyer anyway stands up in the audience when that question was put out. No, I don't think we should hire people with disabilities. They wave a white flag. They don't do a good job. I've had people work with me who have disabilities and they haven't done a good job. So I was kind of sitting there and I was saying to myself, OK, this conference cannot end now on this note. I've put too much work into this. So it was at that moment I just became a different person. Like, this girl who stayed quiet all day long became a different person. And it was at that moment that I used my voice wisely. And that's why I try and encourage other people to use your voice wisely. And I made sure that everybody leaving that room that day did not have the impression, a negative impression of disability. Because I showed that, yes, that's your experience of one Spanish legal trainee solicitor, but like myself and other people with disabilities have worked hard throughout our life, and maybe had we had more support, then we'd be able to get places quicker. But I suppose you have to realise that that's only one experience. Don't paint everybody with the same brush.
Fair play. It was great self-awareness and the personal skills there, and your good point. Like, the loudest person in the room doesn't always, you know, make the best points, and you bide your time, and then you're waiting for it to come in with something really relevant and powerful, and it seems like it went down really well.
Yeah, well, I think for me that in life, if you know what your values are in life, then, like, I've been in a lot of situations where decision making can be tough, as in what to do and all that. But I think if you're very clear on your values, then Like, and you know what your values are if something triggers you. So like one of my values would be inclusion and equality. So I was triggered by what he was saying in the audience. So obviously then that is one of my values. Another one of my values in life would be adventure. So like, and that comes across through like my running, my speaking allows me to travel the world. And so therefore adventure is one of my values. Achievement would be another one of my values. So I'm the type of person where I just don't really compare myself to others, but I try and be that 1% better tomorrow than what I am today. It's not always easy. It can be very difficult. I can have a lot of days where I'm down. I'm just not on form. And I just say to myself, okay, I'm going to allow myself go through this now. I'm human. I'm going to experience these emotions. But like, I then say to myself, okay, right, Sinead, you've went through the emotions now. The following day, you have to snap out of this because the world is still moving and nobody's going to do any of this for you. Like, if you want to get places, you have to kind of be taking the action.
Are you still a solicitor today or are you doing
it? I'm not practicing as a solicitor at the moment. No.
Public is all
speaking,
public.
Yeah, speaking and running. So I suppose my lifestyle probably doesn't allow me be practicing as a solicitor 9 to 5. Yeah. Like, it, I suppose. Like maybe like if a solicitor company wants somebody to be flexible, then so be it. But my lifestyle doesn't fully allow it at the moment.
Tell us about your 2 Guinness World Records.
So I have a Guinness World Record for furthest distance for any female on a treadmill in 12 hours. So that's 130.5.
Any breaks?
There.
You get off to go to the toilet, have something to eat. How does it work?
So the thing is that the treadmill would only actually run for 4 hours. So whether I wanted it to stop, it had to stop after 4 hours. So so then you see the clock is still ticking.
Right? Yeah.
You can't say, okay, the treadmill is stopping, I'm going to stop time now. The clock still ticks. So then you're under pressure then to make up those few seconds or whatever. Because and then, so for that first, at the 4 hours, I said to myself, okay, because the treadmill has to be recalibrated or rebooted now, I'll go to the bathroom. So literally in the preparation of training for the treadmill record, I practiced how long it would take me to get off the treadmill, to get into the bathroom, basically go toilet, don't flush toilet, hands under the hygiene thing, and basically back out. Just let my team flush the toilet for me. It's because every second counts, and then you're back out. So then in the second 4 hours, so when it was coming to 8 hours, I kept looking forward. That was a big thing now for me, that the treadmill was stopping at 8 hours and that I was going to get a break then. So I kept telling myself, the self-talk in my head was like, oh, you're getting a break, you're getting a break. And it was like nearly like you're getting a 3 hour break, but really in reality you're only like getting 3 seconds or 3 minutes or maybe 30 seconds or so. But when it came to 8 hours anyway, I decided not to go to the toilet or anything. And while they were trying to restart the treadmill, I kept jogging on the spot. And my team were thinking like, Sinead, you're absolutely mad. Like the this distance that you're doing isn't being counted because the treadmill is restarting. Yeah. And the reason why I kept running on the spot is because I didn't want to become comfortable. Because I knew if I became comfortable, the mind would automatically say, sure, you ran now. Like, why would you want to start running again? Yeah. Like, no point to start running again. So I just wanted to stay in that state of, look, this will all be over in 4 hours. So when I went onto the treadmill, it's very daunting to say to yourself, I'm standing on a treadmill now for 12 hours and I have to run at a particular pace. Like, because it all came down to the pace. Like, so, because I kind of feel anybody could go on a treadmill for 12 hours at their own pace.
Yeah.
But when you know you have to stick to a pace to break the record. So
what kind of pace have you got the treadmill set to?
So
or does it go up and down?
Yeah, so for the record, we had it at 10.8. But I was more or less, say, running at maybe 11 or 11.1 to make up the break of the at the 4 hour mark of restarting the treadmill and the 8 hour mark to restart treadmill. So that was like probably 7 kilometres an hour.
How does it work then, having the Guinness World Records come over, and what's the setup like?
Yeah, so then a Guinness World Record adjudicator, if you're willing to pay that, which is extremely expensive, that person can come over.
Expensive, can you say?
10,000 euros expensive. Yeah. So he come over, and if you get the record, he'll actually have the record printed and everything like that with your name on it when he comes over. And in a kind of way, like, if you don't do it, he'll just take the record away with him and then dump it or destroy it or do whatever. But he comes over with the record and then monitors it and looks at video footage and looks at witness statements. There's a lot of admin that goes with it. And like, I suffer from self-doubt sometimes. Like, everybody say, oh, you're very positive, you're very motivated. But like, I'm human and I do suffer with self-doubt. And the treadmill record was to go ahead on the Monday. And on the previous Thursday, I looked up the girl who had the record, and she had all these achievements listed beside her name. And so then on the Thursday, I just became overwhelmed with all that. And I said, like, she has no disability and she's all these achievements. How can I break her record? I can't break her record, so no point in attempting it. So then I rang my run coach on the Thursday and I said, look, I know everything's set up now for Monday, but I'm actually not doing it. And he said, why are you not doing it? I was like, oh, because I looked at this girl and she has too many records and I just can't compete with that. And he kind of tried to bring me back down to earth. And he was like, look, Sinead, focus on yourself, focus on your own strengths. Like, when you're out running, you have a guide runner, so you can't listen to music. On the treadmill, you're going to be able to listen to music for 12 hours. That's a luxury for you. So focus on your strengths, focus on how it's going to be different. And I remember he kind of got me into a frame of mind that, like, if I didn't do it, I would always be wondering what if. Yeah. And I think as well that, like, that isn't it better to try and fail and experience that failure than not try at all?
You could say cost you nothing to try, but it cost no 10 grand to try.
So, well, I had a sponsor, thankfully, but... Yeah. And I think you're the average of the 5 people you surround yourself with.
Yeah.
And like, having that, sometimes for belief in yourself, you need other people to believe in you. And my run coach believed in me. Mm. So that's what got me on the treadmill. And I suppose come that last hour, from hour 11 to hour 12, like, all that I kept thinking in my mind was, do not mess this up. Do not mess this up. I couldn't tell you who was in the room that in between hour 11 and 12. There could be some people there now and they'd be showboating and looking around and who's there and running fast or whatever. I just kept saying, because if I came off, if I say gripped the handlebars, or if I came off the treadmill just by mistake because of maybe turning around, then I'm disqualified then because of holding the handlebars. And so I said to myself, do not mess this up now. Do not showboat. It's just one more hour. Get the job done. So I suppose that's what kind of it was just me in the treadmill, even though I was in a room full packed with everybody. And I remember at the end of the treadmill then, because it was done in the Clayton Hotel in Dublin, the staff had a bottle of champagne ready for when I came off it. And I was like, I can't actually drink any more fluid. I actually just can't. Because like, when you're drinking water for a whole 12 hours, the last thing you want is more liquid.
A steak, you should have given
that. But anyway, the team around me, they definitely drank the champagne. So that's the one Guinness record. And then the second then is for doing 7 marathons, 7 continents, 7 days, which is 6 days, 9 hours. So I went to Antarctica, Chile,
Miami, Madrid, Marrakesh, Dubai,
and Sydney. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yes, that's some going. Do you want to explain to people how you actually get to?
So it was a chartered plane, and there was 33 athletes on it, and I suppose myself and another girl, we would have been seen as the inspirational athlete. So she was dealing with brain cancer for the last 10 years. So I had my disability. Then there was other athletes there doing it for charity. There was other athletes there doing it for their own reasons. Athletes there because they just wanted to basically do 7 marathons, 7 continents, 7 days. So we were all there for different reasons, and there was 3 sportsmanship awards, $15,000, $10,000 and $5,000. And you had to write down like the 3 athletes who you believe should get it, and the other athletes nominated me to get the $10,000. And I suppose rather than keep it, I gave it to the Irish Guide Dogs, because I suppose that has been instilled in me from a very young age. It's important to give back to society. I gave it to the Irish Guide Dogs.
That's beautiful. You didn't forget them, like.
Yeah, I've done a lot of charity work all throughout my life.
Have you done a lot for the Irish Guide Dogs?
Have I what?
Done a lot of charity for...
Yeah.
Have you met Roy Keane?
Yeah.
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So,
you never get him for the podcast, Russ, do you?
I'll say to the Guide Dogs to try and get him to come on.
Do. David, what's your life like now? I know you're carrying an injury at the moment.
Yeah, so basically I've this foot... thing on me at the moment, and foot boot, because I had an accident there last August. Woman on a knee bike crashed into my back, so been dealing with a foot injury since then. But I suppose my goals going forward would be to try and get to the Paralympic marathon next year, because all my running to date has been competing against able-bodied. So like, I've represented Ireland at world level, European level, in 24-hour running. So I never knew 24-hour running existed until a few years ago. And how that works is basically in 24 hours, all the athletes go out and they all run, and whoever completes the furthest distance in the 24 hours wins. I've come second female in 3 12-hour races. And I remember at my first 12-hour race, I went there and I could hear somebody say, "Asher, God love us, look at the poor blind girl." And I heard this guy say that, and I just went mad with that comment. So I went to go over to say something, and my few friends that was around me at the time, running guides, etc., said, "Look, let your actions do the talking." And so my actions was that I ended up on the podium, second female. And in that race, I was the only person with a disability. And what I learned, as I was telling you earlier, is that men don't like being beaten by a girl, and they definitely don't like being beaten by a blind girl. And so that person made it very well known that they just weren't happy that I beat them in that race.
You've never, ever left your disability to get you down. Like, you're after accomplishing so much.
Well,
solicitor, you've done 7 marathons and 7 continents in 7 days. Like, that for me is, whoa. And then to run for 12 hours straight, it's like you're a superhuman human being, if that makes sense.
Well,
Like, you can classify it as a disability, our people can, but I look at it as probably one of your biggest strengths, because it's one of these things that growing up, you were told you can't do this, you can't do that, and you can't do the other. But you said, no, I can.
Yeah.
And I can.
Well, I've advocated on a daily basis, not only for myself, but others. And like, I've got policy changed, and like, running has brought me to many highs in my life, but it has also brought me to many lows. So I was explaining how I got to represent Ireland at 24-hour European and World Championship. And I remember back in, I'll just tell you this story fast. I'll try and summarise it. But I set myself the goal to get onto the Irish team, and I was competing against all able-bodied. And to get onto the Irish team, a female has to get above 200 kilometres or above in a 24-hour race. So in April 2019, I got that at a race in the UK. I got 204.6 kilometres in a 24-hour race. Came second female, came fourth overall. So I thought I was going to be selected to represent Ireland at this 24-hour World Championship, which was going to be going ahead in Albi, France. So in the July 2019, expected my name on the Athletics Ireland website, wasn't there. I questioned Athletics Ireland as to why my name wasn't there. They said, we can't select you because the IAU, International Association of Ultra Running, have stated that you're breaching an IAAF rule, which states that no athlete is allowed outside assistance. My guide runner was deemed as outside assistance. So they said that... they said that I would have an unfair advantage to fully sighted runners by using my guide runner. So I thought to myself...
He's not trying to open his fucking back at all, like, Jesus Christ.
So
an unfair advantage, Jason.
So I said to them, that's fine. If you feel that I have an unfair advantage to fully sighted runners, what we'll do is we'll make all the fully sighted runners wear a blindfold and then we're all on an equal par.
Mm.
But anyway, they didn't want to go with that option. So I learned... Like, I learned more about law through my own personal experience than through law books. So straight away into the sports law textbooks to see, okay, how am I going to get through this? And so I basically had to take a legal case against them, against the IAU, and which cost well in excess of thousands, a lot of money. And like, not everybody has that money to take. And I was saying to myself, like, why am I actually taking this legal case? And I'm taking it because I believe in equality, I believe in inclusion, and what they're doing to me is wrong. And at that time, though, I kept trying to keep myself positive. I kept trying to hold on to hope, because I think when you're in a very dark place, if you can hold on to hope, that can get you through. And so I just kept holding on to the hope that I would be on the team. And and even I had to be making decisions with solicitors and barristers at 1 a.m. in the morning and all of this. And the other side had to give a decision on the Wednesday by 5 p.m. whether I was going to be allowed on the team. And the Irish team were flying out on the Thursday morning. The other side came with their decision at 4:59 on the Wednesday to state that I could go out. But sure, at that stage, it was going to be too late for me to get a flight. So preparation, I had booked my flight the weekend before. But it just, like, that court case and that struggle to get on the team, all because I had a disability, which should have never, ever been an issue, that really brought me to a low place in my life, like really, really low place in my life. And I suppose I just, like... simple tasks every day of, I don't know, just very, very simple tasks. Like my achievement back then in 2019, October 2019, when trying to fight that legal case, was like actually getting up and getting dressed. Like that was a big day for me. And like, I suppose if I was to say to myself, like, why do I keep fighting and what gets me through? It's about having hope. And I remind myself of what my surname means. So my surname is Cain. And when you look up the meaning of the name Cain, the meaning of Cain is little battler. Yeah. So I kind of feel like that I'm a little battler and
warrior. Just
fighting on. Yeah, so like, yeah, running has brought me to high, but that advocating for myself during that court case was difficult.
You know, to close out the podcast, have you any advice for somebody that might be struggling with a disability or otherwise?
Yeah.
They might be lacking motivation or just stuck in a rut or in a dark place and is trying to get out of it. Have you any words of wisdom?
I think that, like, start small and try and, like, just, it's the whole thing about the whole eating of the elephant. Just try and break it down into smaller chunks. Try and find something in the day to do that makes you feel productive. Like, I think for me, resilience is a lot about confidence. Like, when we encounter setbacks, it's a knock of our confidence. Mm-hmm. So if you can try and find ways to build your confidence, for me as well, movement is so important. Like, everybody talks about exercise, but if you reframe it and talk about, okay, movement, how much movement have I done today? Getting outside, like, and even say with running, like, everybody says, oh, you must love running, but sometimes I hate going for a run. But it's the action. Like, motivation doesn't come, the motivation, it's the action comes first, then the motivation will come.
Yeah.
So that's what I'd say. Start small, try and get outside, get moving. It really helps the head and find things that build your confidence. Surround yourself with supportive people that want to build you up.
It's interesting you said about the action has to come and then the motivation will follow. Because in recovery, we have a saying, you know, for people that are maybe hesitant or tentative about going to self-help meetings, which are very important, there's a saying, like, if you bring your body, the mind will follow eventually. You know, you put yourself in the seas in spite of yourself, and eventually you'll realise that that's where you should be, and it won't be such a task, you know.
Yeah. But the tennis ball will move. If you move, it will roll if you roll it.
Exactly.
Otherwise, it's going to stand still.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a million.
Definitely one of the most inspiring people I've ever met.
100%. Yeah. Me too. Definitely. 100 million percent.
Stay visionary.
I was listening to your bit of advice there because I recently started jogging as well, and I'm trying to get into the jogging scene. So I'm doing a 10K in the Cork City Marathon with my son soon. And it was exactly what I'm trying to do, work my way up to a certain stage. And I had an injury a few weeks ago, and I kind of had to say, right, we'll get back. We'll get whatever physio we need and get back on the wagon. Because you can actually stop your little bit of a run as well. You know, your bit of motivation when an injury comes. But I took it all on board, you know, every single bit of it. And I'm going to make a go and build up my legs so I can...
But even like... that experience of running with your son, the bond that obviously is being created between the two of you through the action of running.
Will I tell you, we went out for a jog last night, the two of us, and I think we'd done about 8.5 kilometres, and he turned around to me. He was a bit ahead of me. He's a fit kid. And he turns around and he shouts back and he says, "Dad, are you all right? Am I going too fast for you?" You know, and I says, "No, you're fine.
You're grounded."
Yeah. I says, "You're fine." He says, Grand, I'll keep it at this pace, you know?
Yeah.
And it was great.
You say to him, "It's fine to show me up in training, just don't show me up in the day."
He caught me then on Baker's Hill, James. You know, Baker's Hill is like, it's just like pinking up into the ceiling, it's like that. I had to walk up as I couldn't, the calves were so tight. The stretching them, you know, going up was too damaging. But listen, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on.
Well, you're being an extremely inspiring role model.
Thank you.
Going out running with your child.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks, Sinead. See everybody next week. God bless, lads.
Bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.